And the supreme cloak which conceals the true purpose of God is the world, the whole of nature, all of which is the garment of divinity. And to those who are very wise and mystically inclined, those who have had illumination, perceive the fact directly, because they penetrate the cloak and are able to commune directly with their Father. This situation has many interesting possibilities for development, but it certainly lingers as one of the more probable elements in the interpretation of the story. Now, the other members of the cast also have their parts to play, but they are all related to the world of form. These are the three that I have mentioned are the principles. The others are the manifestations of these principles through use or abuse. Antonio is the perversion of religion, perversion of knowledge. He is the one who has falsely taken the control of the universe from his brother and has assumed tyranny. Now, this type of thinking reminds us, of course, that Bacon was fully aware, even in his own time, of the tremendous abuses that were going to arise in the effort to unfold his teaching. He knew that the first thing the human being would do with greater knowledge is to abuse it. He realized, therefore, that it was very necessary in some way to convert his brother rather than destroy him. He had to find some way of exposing his own truth. Prospero had to prove that the spirit cannot die, cannot be completely destroyed, and that ultimately it must reveal itself to his corrupt brother. Another pack factor in the course is Ferdinand. Ferdinand represents, in the old mystery system, the candidate seeking initiation. In other words, Ferdinand is by nature an honorable person. He was the first to leap into the sea from the ship in the delusion, which indicates that he was courageous. He was resolved to swim across the interval and finally reach the truth. Ferdinand, naturally, and undoubtedly with the contrivance of the stagecraft, actually becomes enamored of Miranda, who represents his own soul. Miranda is the blessed damoiselle of Rossetti, and is the wonderful, mysterious Beatrice of Dante. She represents to Ferdinand the principle of love, the principle that love must be part of the great triad. For the problem of virtue lies in wisdom, love, and integrity. These principles bring them together, and Ferdinand becomes inevitably the bridegroom in this apocalyptic fantasy. Most of the other characters have been introduced primarily for the purposes of a court mask. The sailors, with their robust humor, and the other individuals involved, have very little real significance in the play. They are used most often to tell some part of the production that is not shown. Caliban, however, does come in with considerable force. He is described as a monster. And when Prospero tries to teach him to speak, Caliban says all he has learned is to swear better. He is able to curse more grammatically. Now, Caliban obviously represents in the field of knowledge not only natural ignorance, but a kind of depravity. Caliban is materialism. He represents the power that is constantly attempting to justify its own angers, hates, fears, and appetites at the expense of the new way of life, the new order of learning. Caliban is the inevitable result of the increase of skill without the increase of integrity. Actually, Caliban attempts to assassinate Prospero. He attempts to destroy wisdom because wisdom is an appetite he does not know how to satisfy. He wants to destroy the thing that interferes with his right to be wrong. He wants to use all of the skills that have been part of Prospero's magic simply to advance his own animalistic tendencies. Materialism, therefore, declares war against integrity, against the new order of learning. Materialism takes the wand and the magic coat to cover its own nefarious actions. Materialism wants knowledge only for one thing, and that is personal gratification, and that is Caliban's keynote. He is not interested in the improvement of anything except his own fortunes, and he hasn't the intelligence to do anything with his own fortunes. He is simply a blind, bestial dedication to gratification. In this instance also, we have a little thought for Ariel. Now, Ariel is one of the interesting characters that appear in certain of the Shakespearean plays. Puck in the Midsummer Night's Dream is another. Ariel is a spirit. His name suggests air. But there is more to him than merely atmosphere. Ariel represents power. He is the force, the energy, the life, the vitality in things. He is the one power upon which all science, all philosophy, and all religion depend. He is also the power upon which every living creature depends for its own existence. He is invisible, except on occasion. He is also a little rebellious against the bondage to Prospero. And he is constantly urging for Prospero to let him free or set him loose from the control of Prospero's magic power. There we have force. And we have a modern counterpart for this situation, power. Someone once asked Steinmetz what the universal principle was, and he replied instantly, power. The mysterious power, not the kind that is tyrannical, but the power that activates, the power that becomes the moving and living force behind all life. He is the messenger. He carries out the orders. He is subordinate to Prospero, but he flies about the world in the twinkling of an eye and almost travels as fast as modern television or these different international communication media. He goes where he pleases. He can be fire in St. Elmo's fire on the masts of ships. He can do all kinds of things. He has innumerable appearances. But always he is begging Prospero to set him free. Now, this can be given quite an interesting interpretation. We are now having a little trouble with our nuclear installations. We are a little afraid of them. We suspect that we are doing things that we don't understand. And what is this nuclear rebellion which is cutting down or shutting down so many of these plants? It is power seeking to be free, to do as it pleases, and man variously imprisoning it. variously directing it or misdirecting it. In the Baconian theory, power is a manifestation of the divine will. Even Schopenhauer comes pretty close to that thought. Power is the ability that does everything. In the hands of Prospero, this power becomes his messenger. And through its use, he finally arbitrates all his differences and forgives all of his enemies. Prospero uses force to set up an illusion and then uses force to overcome that illusion and restore truth. So Ariel is very difficult to portray in this play, which has led many people to the suspicion, which is probably true, that The Tempest was not primarily intended ever to be performed. It was to be read. Its general theme was certainly not within the scope of the average Elizabethan theatergoer. It required a great deal more insight and care and consideration. Now to go back again to some of the earlier points. The play has, I feel, an astronomical foundation also. And it is founded not upon the Copernican theory, but rather upon the ancient system of Ptolemy. For all religions of the ancient world were finally summarized in Ptolemaic astronomy. It became the skeleton on which all the different draperies of beliefs were hung. They all obeyed and agreed with this essential principle. So that it's quite possible and proper to see how this would cooperate with our general discussion. Those of you who are familiar with the geocentric system of astronomy, which was the system endorsed by Ptolemy and prevalent until the 17th century, this system placed the Earth in the center of the solar system. And by the way, the solar system and its old drawings and figures makes a perfect magic island. The solar system is a magic island. It is an island floating in the sea of space. It is also an island to which many creatures, including man, have been exiled. And many philosophical works, particularly those involving the Robinsonaden or Robinson Crusoe cycle, show man to be a castaway upon a desert island, which he must gradually transform by his own skills. In any event, in the Ptolemaic system, the Earth is the center. And from the body or physical body of the Earth, there are certain extending bands for the elements, the four elements of the ancients, which they considered to form Earth, were earth, water, fire, and air. These were the elements. And these were the constituent parts of Earth as known to the ancients. Outside of these divisions were the orbits of the seven planets known to antiquity. They did not account the Earth a planet. Therefore, this following the Gnostic and Ptolemaic system was called the eighth sphere, the physical Earth. And in the Gnostic writings, it is called the abortio. The other planets, however, are in their proper order. Above the orbit of the four elements is the orbit of the moon, above that of Mercury, from which one rises to Venus, then to the sun, after that to Mars, then to Jupiter, and finally to Saturn, who in a sense has drawn the magic circle around the solar system. Now if we wish to make an astronomical parallel, therefore, we can start by simply saying that Saturn is Prospero. The powers of Saturn, as discussed in various astrological writings, fully support this. Saturn in the 10th house, which is its natural home, is the ruler. He is the head of everything. He is the leader. He is the one who appoints the representatives. And unless perverted or by some bad combination, he rules righteously. and contains within himself the principles of all the other planets. Below him is Jupiter, the most philosophical of the planets in astrology. This is Gonzalo, who is involved in learning. Jupiter rules higher education, all these things. He is involved in learning. He is involved in interpretation. He is involved in revelation, unfoldment, and reformation of learning. The third one is Mars, who undoubtedly represents Antonio, because Antonio and Mars are both symbols of violence, of aggressiveness. A good Mars is one of courage. A bad one is one of treasons, stratagems, and spoils. A deceiver, a destroyer of good. The next is the Sun in this order, and he is Ferdinand. Because Ferdinand, in the ancient mysteries, was always the candidate for the Sun. And the journey through the mysteries was always patterned by the journey of the Sun through the zodiac. Therefore, the candidate played the Sun. That below that is Venus, who corresponds to the King of Naples, who is just returning from marrying his daughter to the King of Tunis. He is a symbol of emotional unrest. He is constantly involved in the use of emotions to advance his own temporal power by forming allegiances. Alfonso, then, is emotional disturbance, and also, to most people, a symbol of the perversion of emotion for self-gratification. Below that is, of course, Mercury. And what could Mercury be better than Ariel? Mercury was the messenger of the gods. He was Prospero's messenger. He was the communicator that bound heaven and earth. He was the brilliance of the quick mind, but he was also the mysterious power of vitality. Therefore, Mercury was a kind of universal agent, perhaps the same agent that Paracelsus called Azoth. That which a man can possess it will make him able to go everywhere, be everything, and do everything within the boundaries of his philosophical understanding. The moon, of course, is Miranda. And here we have another very interesting symbolism. For the moon is the mother of the mysteries. She is the great Isis, whose veil no man can lift. She is the Mater Deorum, the mother of gods. And in the Greek, she is Rhea. In Christianity, she is the Madonna. Therefore, she properly represents the moon. Now, there's an interesting point in this that perhaps many people haven't noticed, and that is that we have a touch of alchemy thrown in on us at this point as a means of establishing something that might otherwise be difficult to understand. For in alchemy, the great work is accomplished by the marriage of the sun and moon. So the happy marriage of Ferdinand and Miranda represents the philosophic union. It represents that union within consciousness itself by which all living things will dwell together in happiness forever. The Chinese have exactly the same thought in their cinnabar alchemy, for they also refer to the medicine of the sun and moon. The union of the sun and moon is the final reconciliation. And as soon as Prospero has achieved his end in the romance between his daughter and Ferdinand, he begins to undo his magic, because it becomes no longer necessary. We have all these elements, and of course in this pattern, the eighth sphere left out, the abortio, is Caliban. The symbol of the lower material side of life. The Arabs had an ancient belief that all the evil in the world finally was filtered out of our atmosphere and made into the body of a dark star which circles around the orbit of the Earth. Now, efforts have been made to distinguish this. Some astrologers have tried to identify it with Lilith, the demon wife of Adam. But in any respect, it is the symbol of Caliban as they unregenerate, the unredeemed, but to be redeemed in the due course of time. The body cannot redeem itself. It has to be redeemed by the powers within it. And when these powers do not concentrate upon that effort, Caliban remains a monster. There is a further clue to this in the fact that the material earth is supposed to be surrounded or composed of four elements: earth, water, fire, and air. Each of these has an astrological symbol. Each of these has an emblematic symbol associated with it. And the body of Caliban is a composite made up of these symbols. He represents all the four elements in their monstrous compound, which we call the world. Now, as we think a little deeper into this thing, we come against something else that's rather confusing but intriguing, and that is the Hermetic axiom: that which is above is like unto that which is below, and that which is below is like unto that which is above. This is said to have been inscribed on the emerald tablet found by Alexander the Great in the tomb of Alexander, in the tomb of Hermes. In this particular case, the law of analogy intrigues us to wonder what the relation may be between the world form, the world pattern, the world intrigue, and man himself as a person. There is no doubt in the world that Bacon's primary consideration in all of his works was the improvement of man, the regeneration of the human being by providing him with facts, with realities so inevitable that he could not refute them. Man's regeneration depends upon his return to the divine plan by which he was fashioned. He must obey that which was created to command. He must be part of a plan in which principles are immutable, and the individual can never be free except by obeying. So we come now to man himself and his composite constitution, and this seems likewise to have a place in the story of the tempest. Most of those who are interested in esoteric matters at all are aware of the multiple bodies of man. They are aware of the auric field in which abide the principles of life and also the seeds of the various lower vehicles which involve the lower mind, the emotions, the vitality, and the form. Here we have, therefore, a triad of principles manifesting through a quadrad of bodies or vehicles. This is very much in line, for here we find Prospero, the spirit. The spirit, the highest part of man's constitution, by which it is one with and indivisible from the universal spirit. And for all practical purposes, the spirit in man is an aspect of the universal life principle. God in man is the fragment, so to say, of the God in space. This relationship gives finally to the spirit ultimate authority. But the spirit is cloaked in bodies, and therefore its direct influence upon man's conscious personality is impaired. The average individual would hardly like to promise or swear that he had a spirit. He does not know what it is. He does not know how to give allegiance to it, because he cannot hear its voice directly, nor can he see it. Therefore, to man, the spirit is a mystery. It is a mystery inscribed and encircled within an enigma. Actually, however, the center section, or the second person of the Trinity in man, called in the Orient the Buddhic sheet, is partly available. For in the Greek system, the soul, or the second person, the Savior principle, the Redeemer, is located symbolically in the human heart. The Spirit is mysteriously hidden within the deepest fastnesses of the brain, but also in the absolute circumference of the magnetic field. The God within is also the boundary of man's auric structure. Therefore, the soul now becomes the second person of the Trinity. The soul is the redeeming power. The soul is the only begotten of the Father. Miranda was Prospero's only child. And the Spirit instructs the soul in dreams, in visions, in mystical experiences, in strange magic rites which we do not understand and are apt to profane. But the soul becomes the communicating power. It is the middle distance between eternity and time. It is that which by its own nature is able to speak or know its Father when he has removed his cloak. When all appearances, all circumstances, all incidents have been removed, the soul communes with its own source. The third of the great principles, the Manas of India, is the mind. And the mind now is Gonzales. Now the mind, as we study it, like all of the other bodies of which it is the highest, is stratified. There are many levels of the mind. The most common division is the division between abstract and concrete mind. Abstract mind is best perhaps represented by Gonzales, because he represents thought in principles. Whereas the concrete mind, which is only able to see the outer semblances of things, is more or less captured in the various persons that become incidental to the story, because all its labors are incidental. In the level and substance of the mind itself, in the higher realms of intellect, is the seat of what we term the self, which some call the ego. Others like to think of it as the I in us. This corresponds with individuality and is Ferdinand, has the power to gradually unfold its own resources. In other words, Ferdinand is the personality seeking to be re-identified with its own source. Below this, we also have the various levels of emotion. We have the struggle of the abstract and concrete appetite. We have this strange problem that is so well set forth in the dialogues involving Alfonso, the king of Naples. Confusion, the effort to apply emotions to the advantage of some purpose. Anger, disillusionment, conspiracy, not on the mental plane alone, but the urge to these things as emotional factors in life. Therefore, we find that man's emotional nature is torn between good and evil, between truth and error. And by emotions, he drifts towards the gratification of lower appetites or ascends to the realization of higher destiny. Below the emotional nature, of course, is the energy body, called the etheric double by some, vital body by others, the Akashic field by still others. Here we have definitely the symbolism of Ariel. Ariel can be transformed immediately into the human nervous system, just as Alfonso can be the veins, and each of the levels has its own proper representative. This Ariel now is the life with which we move and have our being. If anything impairs that life, we have paralysis. If it is too greatly impaired and the life supply is cut off, we have death. But life itself does not die. It continues to exist in space forever. But the vital body of man is the link between the two higher bodies and the physical form. If this link is disturbed, then sickness of various kinds steps in. And it was one of the Paracelsian axioms that most diseases originate not in the body, but are transferred to it by abnormalities in the magnetic field. But Ariel, bright as he is, also vitalizes the other bodies. He vitalizes the emotions. He vitalizes the mind. But he only serves Prospero. Now, in the vitalizing of the various aspects of life, which he has as his peculiar promise, he also is trying to be free. He wants to be liberated from the control of spirit. This is an appearance rather than a fact, because he is the energy of spirit itself. Prospero tells him that in due time he will be free. Now, the free use of energy is its proper use. It is its use as a building power, a constant reminder to us all that the energy by which we do anything is the divine energy, that it is given to us for a purpose, for a dedication. We cannot lift our hand without it. But what happens when we lift our hand against our brother? This is disruption of energy. This is abuse of it. And from this abuse, numerous and innumerable tragedies result. Therefore, Prospero continually promises Ariel his ultimate freedom, but does not bestow it immediately. Because man cannot have the full control of vitality until he knows how to use it. In technical thinking, the complete control of this vital principle could end in physical immortality. Because if the flow of energy is not intercepted, and in some way blocked, organs continue to function, the mind continues to dream, and all things continue to go in the direction which they are intended to go. Actually, as a vital principle also, Ariel has another facet to his nature, and that is that he is the power of imagination. Imagination, in some way, by the ancients, was linked with the nervous system, which is probably proper. But it's a combination of emotion, of thought, and of vitality. And these being combined in Ariel, we see how they can work out. Actually, as Bacon himself tells us, the whole of creation is a dream. The great problem is that man must learn to dream true. He must learn to recognize that dreams have a strange substance in them, and that perhaps the most important of all dreams is the dream of a better world to come. Where imagination projects us into the future, it provides us with the incentives to achieve that future. If we live always in the very commonplace atmosphere of our own mediocrity, we are afraid to dream. And if we do dream, we're apt to have nightmares. But to dream true is to anticipate something better. And Bacon's great dream of the New Atlantis was a dreaming true. It was the building of a vision, of a kind of architect's diagram, something that did not yet exist in mortar and stone. But this diagram, this picture, this plan would someday be fulfilled. And it is thus with the great dreams of mankind, our sages, our saints, our scholars, our mystics, altogether. They are the ones that are dreaming of the solutions to things. And there's not enough of that dreaming today. We are all locked in the immediate. We are afraid to think of tomorrow, and we do not want to remember yesterday. But actually, to look forward to something greater and something better is absolutely necessary to us. Bacon could imagine what was going to come, but he could only lay the foundations. And each of us, each nation, each individual, each generation, has to build a solid foundation under its dreams, its visions, its hopes, its dedications. It must build and count much on the substance of things unseen, because it is within ourselves, in our own inner lives, that we are the architects of the world's future. So if you put all these things together and make a kind of a picture out of them, I think you can read The Tempest and get a good deal more out of it, because whoever wrote it was very, very wise and had a skillful knowledge not only of the times in which he lived, but of the future. He was certainly a scholar, a scientist, a philosopher, a mystic. And he also had the skill to put these factors together to form an imagery. And when the play is finished, then Prospero comes out and makes his little epilogue. The curtain goes down, the scenery changes, and the whole drama ends. But before it ends, the reconciliation of the conspirators, the happy union of Ferdinand and Miranda, and the fact that the ship that they thought had been sunk hadn't been sunk at all, and they all gathered on it to go back to their homelands. Each, therefore, went back to his own place, each a little wiser, each a little better for the experience. It is called a comedy because it all ends well. And that is the comedy of life. For somehow, inside of ourselves, in spite of our doubts and apprehensions, there is a realization that comes to us from our own souls, planted there by the great magician of them all, God, planted there to assure us that in the end all will be well. And this is really the idealistic summation of this very extraordinary play. Well, I have a couple of announcements I'd like to make at this time before we all go our ways. First of all, I'd like to tell you that our friends, Dr. Bode and his wife, Homai, are making a little visit here. Take a bow. Take a bow. Also, I have some more news. It's a little interesting. Maybe you've noticed it over there. Movement of the various elements in The Tempest have resulted in a piano. This is a very fine Steinway piano, and I am very much intrigued about it because for a long time I wanted our programs to be stronger in creative arts, because art history, like the story of the play, is the instrument and vehicle for the perpetuation of some of the noblest truths of life, which cannot be actually put into words. So this piano we're very happy about, and you may like to know that at the time of Dr. Drake's death, a number of friends set up a memorial fund for him, and we have purchased this piano as a memorial to Dr. Drake, and it will have a proper inscription upon it and be our testimony to our remembrance of our late Vice President. So we hope that you will all appreciate this particular point. Incidentally, we now have an upright piano that isn't absolutely necessary, and perhaps someone would like to, you know, do something about that, might like to have it, and might like to make a donation for our work. In any event, we're very happy to have you all with us, and we'll see you soon again, and we hope you will join us in future here in our little magic aisle. Thank you very much.